Mary, today we're talking about the subject of money. So when you went on your first date with Nick, who's now your husband, did you split the bill?
You just mind your own business.
I can guess that you split the bill. That's just my idea. I couldn't really picture you sitting back and anyway, I wish you could see the stern look I'm getting from Mary as we speak. It's just my... Hello and welcome. You are listening to Mothers of Invention, the show that explores why climate change, a man-made problem, can be best fixed with a brilliantly feminist solution.
Each episode, we focus on one particular thing that people do that contributes to the greenhouse effect in a big way, like eat food, use plastics, or use energy. And then meet the women from all over the world and all walks of life who are changing the way we do these things in unexpected climate justice and totally genius ways.
I am Maeve Higgins, and if we were on a date and you asked me what do I do, I'd probably say I'm a comedian and I'm a writer and I like to examine serious things in a fun way.
And I'm the former president of Ireland, Mary Robinson, and if we were on a date, then something would have to have gone terribly wrong because I've been happily married to my dear husband, Nick, for some 48 years.
Okay, good point. Nick, right.
I'm doing this show because since being President of Ireland, I've stalked the corridors of power as a UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and as an elder alongside people like Kofi Annan and Nelson Mandela. And for the past 15 years, I've been persuading people in powerful positions around the world to take climate change seriously as a human rights issue, as a justice issue, as well as a scientific one.
Well, we know that money and power are really intrinsically linked. And today we're talking about the fascinating relationship between money and climate change, particularly this one term, divestment. Now, I had to Google what that meant. And it sounds like it's basically the opposite of investment.
Opposite of investment.
Yeah.
And in fact, the best divestment is to get out of the carbon that's harming us and into the renewable energy that's the green jobs and economy of the future.
So it's kind of like if you break up with somebody and then you take back all the cool stuff you gave them and then you start going out with a new person. And
yeah, sort of. I would more equate it with the apartheid era where companies were told don't invest in South Africa because they have an apartheid system and divest from South Africa because of apartheid. That's the way they learn a lesson.
In today's show, we're headed to South Africa, America and London as we meet an incredible array of women.
From one who overthrew apartheid and reveals her techniques for doing the same thing with climate change.
When people's pensions began to disappear because of divestment, that is when the National Party was ready to come to the table and negotiate.
To another who has taken those lessons and started applying them to climate change when she was just an undergrad student and whose work is now being felt globally by all of us.
It's wrong to be an institution of higher learning while simultaneously impacting the very conditions of which that future generation can live.
To an incredible Minnesotan First Nations lawyer who's now travelling the world from financial capital to financial capital, persuading the suits to pull their money out of the oil pipelines in the United States.
For the Norwegian Oil Fund to hear all of those things and to hear those stories was really eye-opening for them. I could see his chin just trembling. It's hard to listen to.
Mary, do you remember that time during apartheid when the divestment movement was really taking off?
Yes, I do. I was part of the anti-apartheid movement in Ireland. And one great champion of it, whom I know a little bit, is Yvette Abrams. She was the Commissioner for Gender Equality in South Africa, and she is a great climate justice activist. Her work focuses on food security, gender, and climate change.
New violence erupts almost every day in South Africa. Increasingly, the streets of the black townships and the white cities are filled with rioting crowds, burning vehicles, armed soldiers, and the dead.
Women have always been the backbone of the struggle. When women decide to ignore an issue, it rolls over and goes away. And when women decide to take up an issue, that's what moves movements. My name is Yvette Abrams. I'm an organic farmer here in Cape Town, South Africa, and I do a small business making natural and organic soaps and other cosmetics. I have a PhD from the Department of History at the University of Cape Town, I specialize in the history of science. So when I came to climate change, I was like, oh, I recognize this. This is very familiar. I've written widely on climate change as the logical endpoint of positivist science.
Blacks have decided to fight for their rights. And they will fight for their rights to the bitter end.
I was 21 when I first joined the student movement. That was my youth. Those 10 years between 21 and 31 were pretty much devoted to the struggle. So I was very much a housewife of the struggle, you know. I was one of those who paid rent and put food on the table, grabbed babies when they were thrown into your arms when somebody got detained, visited lawyers and dropped money at jails. Sometimes I was on the run myself, so... So I would like one day a statue with a broom to the housewives of the struggle. I think the 80s was really the high period of cross-sectoral alliances with our ability to build solidarity across many different ideologies. And I guess in that sense, another very good preparation for climate change, eh? Because it's a very similar problem. What we did is pick companies that we felt were particularly bad and boycott selectively. We would recycle the black rand as much as possible, so we try and find a small black business to spend our money at rather than one of these big multinational companies that were supporting apartheid. We would really give a lot of thought to how you're spending your money and where you're spending it. Divestment was incredibly powerful because it speaks to people's pockets. In my experience, moral suasion might work with a few enlightened souls, but struggle is much more effective once you start taking money out of wallets. With anti-apartheid, what worked were two things. When people's sons started dying on the borders and coming home in body bags, and when people's pensions began to disappear because of divestment, that is when the National Party was ready to come to the table and negotiate. The fossil fuel divestment movement was inspired by that movement. I think it's one of the more powerful angles to climate change work.
There's Mr. Mandela, Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man taking his first steps into a new South Africa.
Now Mr. Mandela walks through the gate. He's a free man. He's waving his fist. The crowd are responding with their fists raised in the air too.
It's very possible that the course of South African politics will take a different turn from this moment.
President de Klerk moved decisively to overturn all the cornerstones supporting over 40 years of statutory white privilege and black inferiority.
Legislation. In 1994, apartheid ended, and Yvette moved on to tackle what was the legacy of apartheid, which was, of course, poverty.
After 94, I took up feminist issues, which was, in a sense, a struggle we'd kind of put on the shelf while we were fighting the broader anti-apartheid struggles. I guess it was a symptom of freedom to say, well, gee, now I can finally focus on women. I worked at a constitutional commission called the Commission for Gender Equality. My job was to monitor government and report to parliament in respect of gender issues. Each had to take a portfolio, and I said, well, I'll do poverty. So I had workshops in every single province in the country, everything from under a tree to the halls of parliament. I mean, I spoke to anybody who would listen. What we found was you couldn't move in poverty, whether you were talking land or water or energy or food. You could move nowhere without coming up against climate change. Women farmers in the remote rural areas had already observed the signs of climate change. They would say things like, the rain came a month late, or we had too little rain, or we had floods more often. We normally only have it once a generation, and now it's been every 5 years, or there's this new insect on the cabbages. Because they knew their ecosystem so well, they'd already observed the changes. What they didn't have was an explanatory model. So when we explained about climate change, they said, ah, now it all makes sense. The white man stole the weather. That was not necessarily the outcome we were looking for, but they now had an explanatory model that tied together all these events that they'd observed, and they had a set of prescriptions for how to mobilize. So it was literally myself and many others about building a mass movement around climate change. The way we did that was to go to women's organizations at every level and get them to make the connections to their daily life.
The lack of rain, accompanied by heat waves, This is the worst drought to hit South Africa since 1982. Millions are facing water shortages.
Global warming's proceeding about twice as fast in Africa as it is in the rest of the world. So denialism cannot flourish here because people cannot ignore the evidence before them. When you're sitting with a daily water ration and when you've used up your ration, the tap gets switched off, you're not going to take any notice of denialists. Now when we're sitting with the water crisis or the energy crisis or the food crisis, around every single one of these issues, there are movements. So people are ready. They are ready, they are organized, and they know what to do. The only piece of the puzzle I'm still grappling with is, I don't know, may I call it the reinvestment movement? How do we channel the money from successful divestments into investments that are constructive? Those alternatives have to be physically there. You cannot responsibly tell a mine worker to pull his pension funds out of a particular investment unless you have a viable alternative. You know, and I may know, that there's no future in coal, but you're asking this man who's worked for this for 30 years to trust you. That's the complicated part. Are we growing the new economy as fast as we're asking people to divest from the old? And that's kind of where I sit and work. You have to be building a new economy. And when you can show somebody a real viable alternative, there's no need for much debate. International solidarity is important. Climate change, it's an issue that's cross-class, it's cross-race, it's cross-gender. You've got to work with a consciousness of intersectionality in the sense that power differentials within the movement have to be both contained and resolved in a way that ultimately strengthens the movement. I work very closely with former anti-apartheid activists, particularly in Germany. Whether you're sitting in Ireland or Timbuktu or in China or Tajikistan, there really is a sense in which we have to pull together as a species to make it happen.
Oh, I love that expression.
Isn't it incredible?
The white man stole the weather.
Mm-hmm.
That is brilliant.
Yeah.
Because it's so true.
Yeah.
Whether it's by denial, whether it's by investing in fossil fuel.
Yeah.
And of course, all over Africa, we're seeing this. Cape Town is running out of water. They've had to ration very severely. And I think it really is important to reflect on what we call the gender dimensions of climate change. Mm-hmm. It actually affects women and men differently because their roles in lots of societies are very different. Their role in providing food for the table is different. Their role in going for water, in going for firewood in many developing countries. Even in developed countries, there is a societal difference. And that's why we need women leaders to take gender and climate change really seriously.
And one who's taking this climate change seriously is May Bove. Do not be fooled by her sweet voice. She's a big deal. In 2007, when she was still an undergraduate at Middlebury, Vermont, she founded, along with six of her college friends and their lecturer, Bill McKibben, 350.org, which propelled the divestment movement in the US.
We had no idea that it was going to take off the way that it did. I think so much of social change is like that. You have a spark of an idea and you think it has potential, but you really can't predict what's going to happen with it. And that was very much the case with divestment. The anti-apartheid campaign in South Africa had a component around divestment. That was really the historical antecedent for this. The logic of the divestment movement is similar to the logic of the anti-tobacco fights, where the tobacco companies were selling a product that they knew was killing people and they lied about it. It's a very similar problem with burning oil, coal, and gas that's causing climate change, which is also killing people. So we had to shift the moral thinking about fossil fuels. One very clear way to do that is investments and money, because it's a way that people make decisions about what's right and wrong. 350.org very much grew out of trying to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. Each time we would have a big win, the next day the industry would come back with yet another plan to try to build the pipeline. We thought, we can't stop climate change one pipeline at a time. We actually have to focus on this industry as a whole and really dramatize the fact that this product, fossil fuels, are what's causing climate change. We wanted to get involved in an effort that would really draw a moral line in the sand about climate change and fossil fuel investments. And the divestment movement really brought that to the fore. I came of age as a university student during the Iraq War. At my campus, Middlebury College in Vermont, there was not a lot of interest among students around the war, which I found very distressing. People felt ambiguous about what difference it would make if they protested a war in Vermont. Who would pay attention? I think for my generation, the much maligned millennials, people accuse millennials of only wanting to participate in activism if they can demonstrate that it's going to do something. I think there's something very valuable about that, because this is a generation that has grown up in a time of incredible economic instability. If you look at the level of opportunities available for young people, especially young people of color, it's a difficult time. So I think if people are going to get involved in political action, they really want to know that it's meaningful. The issue of climate change brought about a total transformation in student activism at my campus. Hundreds of students who really were passionate about climate change saw they could make a difference on this issue right where they were. And it's a problem that connects so many different things that we cared about. Inequality, global poverty, health crises. You could see an impact of climate change in all of those areas. We started getting active, and this was in the mid-2000s. We would do a lot of really creative stuff, like poetry readings about winter. And we had Get Outside Week, where a bunch of people camped out on the quad in the snow to try to make this point about how essential winter is to what it means to live in Vermont. And as a Californian, this was a bit of a leap for me, but that was kind of the spirit of the endeavor.
So it's mid-2009, and May and her friends have set their sights on a new goal, getting their university to divest from fossil fuels.
For students who are trying to convince their university to divest, these situations would happen where they're presenting to the boards of trustees and they're being asked to explain how it's going to impact the returns of the portfolio. The real contribution of the activism is the moral argument to say it's wrong to benefit from this. It's wrong to be an institution of higher learning, educating the next generation, while simultaneously impacting the very conditions of which that future generation can live. There was then a tour that we did around the U.S. I think we went to 22 cities, really, again, laying out the logic and encouraging people to sign up a divestment campaign. The first one that really took hold was actually the very first stop on that tour in Seattle, where the mayor of Seattle, Washington, right on the spot declared Seattle would divest. So much of campaigning and social movement work is about momentum. This set off a wave that helped follow the tour through all of its cities and helped students on campuses pick this up as a strategy. Then it was really a bit of a race to just keep up with the energy.
I am a citizen of Nepal. We have mountains, we have forests, and they are really getting depleted day by day. This is a great platform for me to make my voice heard.
We also spoke with South African activists. Desmond Tutu recorded a statement of support of divestment very early on and really made the link between climate change and ending apartheid. And so it was very much part of the early thinking. There was and is still a fossil fuel divestment effort taking place in South Africa. One of the good criticisms of the divestment movement in particular was the people who speak for it, myself included, are the white people, are the middle class people. So you get this sense that we're making up the whole movement and we're not. A lot of the leadership in this movement is being led a lot by women, a lot by people of color, who are actually the ones who are making sure that a coal plant is not sited in their community and that a pipeline is not built. And so it's really looking seriously at questions of equity about whose work is recognized in public, whose work is recognized with resourcing, getting to a place where we're actually working better together to win.
And then in January 2018, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced the divestment movement's biggest coup so far.
The jury has come back. Climate change is a painful, horrible reality. And so today we announce that the city of New York will divest up to $5 billion from fossil fuel reserve owner companies. We're going after those who have profited. It's time that they are held accountable. It's time that things change in the way we do business, because the way we've been doing it up to now does not make sense anymore.
Now, if you're working on a divestment campaign in Sao Paulo or Middlebury, Vermont, you can go back to your board of trustees and say, did you see the news? New York City just divested. The heart of the financial capital of the world just made this decision. And you're telling me you can't do it? Each win has the power to really generate exponential momentum. And when we're talking about climate change, we can't talk about incrementalism. We have to be entirely focused on exponential change. And so that's what these kinds of wins will do.
And it has been amazing, I must say, to watch how this has unfolded. And more power to 350.org. We have trillions that are moving in the right direction out of supporting fossil fuel. Investment companies are getting the message.
You know, I'm thinking about, there's a line in Beyonce's song where she says, like, make your check come at their neck. And it's basically like, get your money and then you'll be, you know, that's how you get people's attention. And that's the world we're in.
It's true. And it's also true that women working as farmers, as entrepreneurs who are trying to provide the green jobs, the solar, they cannot get climate investment. It doesn't trickle down to them.
So if universities are divesting and cities are divesting, who else and what else can divest?
Whoever is investing in fossil fuels. So obviously states, philanthropies, big civil society organizations could have investments. Everybody needs to make sure that they are thinking seriously about divesting from what is causing harm.
Mm-hmm. And even, I guess, individuals. I know during the kind of Occupy Wall Street movement, a lot of my friends moved their own savings. And I'm talking just about like $5,000 or $10,000 or something, you know, into credit unions or, you know, away from banks.
Well, certainly it's good that the divestment movement emphasizes the need to reinvest. And I think that can also help to open up the fact that solar and wind energy are becoming much cheaper, much more profitable, and it makes every sense from an economic perspective. And one of the groups that to me are kind of heroes of climate are the indigenous peoples worldwide. They save the forests. They have the knowledge of the seeds. Meet Tara Hauske. She's a native rights lawyer from Kutichin First Nation in Minnesota. Here she is in her recent talk at TED Women.
My name is Tara Hauske. I'm Bear Clan from Kutichin First Nation. I was born under the maple sapping moon in International Falls, Minnesota. I'm happy to be here with all of you.
And she was the advisor for Native American Affairs for Bernie Sanders. She was the first college graduate and the first lawyer in her own immediate Indigenous family.
I am a national campaigns director of an organization called Honor the Earth. It is an organization led by Indigenous women, supporting Indigenous struggles around the environment and environmental justice around the country. I'm also an attorney that used to formerly live in Washington, D.C., when I finished law school. I went out and worked in private practice, and that was very, very hard. At the time I moved, it was football season. I never had seen the Washington Redskins play. I had never really encountered that. We banned Native mascots in Minnesota, where I'm from, back in 1992. So that was really eye-opening for me to realize just how negatively and ignorantly Indian people were represented, especially in the nation's capital. One of the issues that had been in front of the White House when I was there was the Keystone XL pipeline. With something like tar sands, it's not just a little bit of oil that spills when these spills happen. It's thousands and thousands of gallons in a single second. When it goes into the water, it doesn't float, it sinks. It's so difficult to clean up. It's just this disgusting substance full of cancer that's going into the water. And so I started going to these protests because it was Indian people and it was something that I was really passionate about. I was like, you know, how could you possibly send tar sands through people's drinking water sources? Especially with the knowledge of all of these tribal nations from around the country and seeing the repeated issues again and again of oppression, environmental injustice, and violence against women brought on by man camps and all these different issues that came across my desk as an attorney. So I basically was in this position of being a full-time first-year associate and then going to protest during my lunch breaks.
I'd like run over in my suit, protest in front of the White House, and then run back and go back to writing a legal brief. At the same time, I started working with this woman named Winona LaDuke. She's an Anishinaabe economist and activist, and started trying to give her free legal services as an attorney within the firm. And then she was like, maybe you should come work for me. And then Standing Rock happened. And this woman, LaDonna Allard, she's a Standing Rock member, put out a message on Facebook asking people to come and help because the machines were here. Seeing the people on Facebook, seeing their live streams of the machines are here, and they were standing in front of them, and there were people gathering, and they were resisting.
In the snows of North Dakota, they were digging in for the long haul. This camp is the largest gathering of Native Americans in living memory. They had come here to fight a pipeline which they say desecrated sacred sites and threatened tribal waters. In recent weeks, there have been bloody clashes between protesters and the authorities.
To the ground, they were targeting the medics with round after round after round of pepper spray. Everyone's just trying to help each other out and survive because we're not going anywhere.
And so I packed up my car and packed up my dog and drove from D.C. out to Standing Rock. I remember one of the very first actions that happened out there. They were bringing in construction equipment. All these men and women were arguing about what to do. And finally, four women just got sick of it and just jumped the fence and went and stood in front of the construction equipment and stopped it for the day.
The company that was building the pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners, is connected to Donald Trump, who has investments in it. The CEO of that company donated $100,000 to President Trump's campaign. And it's true that there's a lot of power politics in all of this. That's something that human rights defenders like Tara have to be willing to suffer personally.
My personal narrative was one of being arrested on a front line and being put into a dog kennel and being strip searched and dehumanized. Seeing Indigenous men and women maced at point blank range, watching teenagers being hit with batons by police officers, watching elders have their sacred objects taken from them and thrown on the ground, being handcuffed in front of me, watching a police officer chasing a teenager on a horse across the plains shooting at them, and knowing all the while that the police were doing these things to people to protect a pipeline and to benefit an industry that is really not necessary.
I'm from McLaughlin, South Dakota, on the Standing Rock Indian Reservation.
I have the resources and the privilege to come out here, dedicate time, attention, and intention.
I come from Oklahoma. I'm a Choctaw.
I am from Rapid City, South Dakota, but I am Rosebud Sioux. I'm a water protector. I'm here to protect the water.
We have allies who recognize that we aren't crazy environmentalists. We aren't people who are more concerned about hugging a tree or something like that than we are about driving a car. No, we're people who want to move into driving a car that is powered by the sun.
I'm pleased to announce that the Dakota Access Pipeline is now officially open for business.
When Trump got elected, it was a very, very low point for a lot of people. Kind of led to this like hopelessness of, you know, what do we do? And this article went out, the 17 banks funding Dakota Access Pipeline. And when that happened, I think a lot of us felt like we should do something else around this. And so we started doing these bank shutdowns where we would just go to a bank branch, we'd go to Wells Fargo, we'd go to Citibank, we'd go to Chase, we'd go to these places where we knew that that bank was directly tied to funding Dakota Access Pipeline and take over the space. People lock themselves to bank doors, people lock themselves to the teller places, you know, all these different things were happening. We would go to all these different places, and it was a lot of people from camp just taking trips and going out and doing these things. We went to New York City, shut down five different banks in one day. We recognized that dealing in terms of morality was not as effective as dealing in terms of money. These companies feel money. That's what they fuel themselves on, and so targeting their investors and targeting the people that were funding these projects was an easy way to hit a forward-facing agency like a bank. Taking and holding space and drawing attention to this,
that quickly spawned into a way for people who wanted to be at Standing Rock and wanted to be part of the resistance to do something in their own locality. How can I get involved? What can I do? How can I help? Take your money out of these banks. Go to these city council meetings and tell your city council to take their money out of these banks. What started as just tribal members turned into all of these nations around the country and then around the world sending their flag and a delegation to come to Standing Rock and to present as Indigenous people united in struggle, because Indigenous peoples understand what this feels like. We are impacted first and worst by climate change. We are the people who are still connected to the land, to the water. This pipeline, we're not going to send it through white suburbia. We're going to send it through some other place no one ever heard of. That's going to be Indian country, or it's going to be a reservation, or it's going to be right next to a reservation, or somewhere remote that people don't see, which oftentimes is places that Native people live. The Sami are people who are Indigenous to Norway. They came over to Standing Rock and spent a great deal of time out there. I was so shocked to see white faces who were Indigenous. When these Sami folks went back, and they were like, what can we do? Now we're back home. Then this piece came out on the banks.
Norway's largest bank, DNB, has reportedly loaned Energy Transfer Partners 10% of the Dakota Access Pipeline's construction costs.
These Sami folks approached DNB, and they approached the Norwegian Oil Fund, and they began these conversations about, you're invested in Energy Transfer Partnership, you're invested in Dakota Access. You're doing this to these people, and here's their story.
Tara herself was invited to be part of a delegation of Indigenous women to travel to Europe, and they met with the Norwegian Oil Fund.
One of the largest funders of fossil fuels in the world, $1 trillion invested in this portfolio of extraction. It's like this weird dynamic of Norway is this beautiful place. Everyone is really environmentally conscious. Everyone is very outdoorsy. They have this great place they live in, and they all recycle. Their carbon footprint is low. But their pension fund is based on the extraction and destruction of communities somewhere else. For the Norwegian Oil Fund to hear all of those things and to hear those stories was really eye-opening for them. In that moment, I remember sitting there and watching. There was one man in the room, and as we were telling our stories and telling our own personal experience, I could see his chin just trembling. It's hard to listen to. They recognize that there is change, that there are Indigenous communities, First Nations communities that have rights that can cost their company a lot of money. That it's not just you can run over people and communities like you always have. People who are allegedly without power, with very little resources, were able to successfully carry a movement that is one of the most significant resistance movements in decades. It was Indigenous peoples telling their own narrative, carrying their own movement, and saying, you can help us in the way that we want you to help us. Allied groups recognizing that it wasn't their struggle and that their job was to help us and to truly support us and not use us as tokens.
That, I think, is a really important issue.
Yeah.
And that they were in charge. It was their decisions. And the others came in to support, but they were the primary agents of change in what they wanted to happen for their community. And they are at the coalface. They are the canaries in the mine. It's so important that voices like Tara's get to those tables, that Indigenous women and grassroots women who are in the front line, who are the experts on how to cope with the situation, get to tell their story to the big oil companies or investors.
And he can't say that he doesn't know now.
That's the point, yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually, the Norwegian Oil Fund did urge the government of Norway to divest $37 billion worth of investments from oil and gas companies.
I obviously hadn't heard of divestment until I started working on this with you. And what's interesting is the Dock Society, who are making this series, they've actually divested all of their money now, Mary, since meeting you.
I like people who walk the talk.
I know. I think they were scared not to. They took their money out of Barclays Bank and then they put it into Triodos, which is a building society with more ethical practices, I suppose, and who don't have money in fossil fuels. I was considering doing the same. I'm not on the board of anything. I'm not a shareholder in anything. But I think I do want to figure out like what my money is being used for.
I presume you have a lot of money that we're talking about now, Maeve.
I'm going to do some investigating and I'd love to tell you how I get on.
Done.
Okay, good. I promise I won't bore you, Mary. I'll be phoning you at 4 a.m. Listen, I only got through to customer services and they don't know where the money is. Like some poor lady in Georgia. Sweetheart, I can't help you. Okay, I'll check it out and I'll be back.
Good.
Mary, thanks for another great episode. It's been such an education, but you still haven't actually told me if you and your husband split the bill on your first meal.
And that is something I will never divulge to you, Maeve. You can find out more about the series, the mothers we've met today, and support them at mothersofinvention.online and follow us for updates and more episodes on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram at mothersinvent.
Mary, I just caught up with you because since we taped this episode, we've had some good news.
We have indeed, because on the 12th of July, Ireland announced that it's withdrawing all monies from fossil fuels. It's divesting from fossil fuels. First country in the world. Now, Ireland isn't perfect on climate change. Our Prime Minister said in the European Parliament that we can be a laggard on climate change and we need to do something about it. This is something. This is a bit of leadership. So I'm very happy.
Isn't it great?
It is good.
Rule of us for Ireland. Mothers of Invention is a production of Doc Society, recorded in Dublin, London and New York, and made possible by the Compton Foundation. The chief banker and series producer is Lena Prestwood, and this episode was produced by Dara Kell and Dasha Litsensina. Our clerks, researchers were Rhiannon Licorice, Aisha Yunus. The chief investors and exec producers are Jess Search and Billy Finzi. It was edited by Samuel Shelton Robinson and Dasha Litsensina. This episode's Super Green Portfolio was mixed by Jim McKee, and our title music is Water Fountain by Tune Yards. Additional music composed by Dan Wilson, Kalu and Poddington Bear. Our financial advisors and consultants are Iris Andrews, Ed King, Catherine Wilkinson and Suzanne Dhaliwal. Our impact producer and personal banker is Hazel Falk.